The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 2. Staying high and dry is more trouble than it's worth. John.
May 3rd, 11:11 a.m. E.B.
Oh man, this is going to be awesome. It will be like a permanent sleepover. I'm a bit worried about your bro, though. From what you've said, he seems...
T.G.
Chill, dude. You probably won't even meet the guy. He fucked off to do something with monsters. Even when he's in town, he's usually in at night and has gone before the sun's up.
E.B.
If you say so. Speaking of monsters, I think I saw a rock again. This time for sure.
T.G.
And I just saw a smoking hot Beckinsale vampire and a latex cat sit in the street. She wanted to suck me so bad, but I was like, nah, I don't need Helsing driving a stake in my ass.
E.B.
It is freaking huge, I swear.
T.G.
You're driving through dirt and oil fields. The only thing that can live out there is vultures. Does its head look like an uncircumcised penis?
E.B.
Ew. I can't tell from this distance.
T.G.
Shit, it could be anything then. I guess biomes are all changed with the sea levels, though. Probably all sorts of majestic fucking seabirds coasting through. My crib's property value through the roof of this seaside view, now.
E.B.
You really can see the ocean from your apartment?
T.G.
Sure as shit. Took out the Waffle House and plenty of high-rises sticking out, but I'll be fucked if Houston isn't the premier scenic vacation destination by next year. As soon as this rain lets up. This rain better let up.
E.B.
That rules! We're hitting low signal, but I'll message when we get in range again. Talk to you later. Actually, see you later.
T.G.
Hella.
John snapped his hand-me-down PDA off, his 16th birthday gift from his dad, who was currently sweating profusely from the humidity despite the car's blasting AC. Dad, I told you that you didn't have to wear your slacks and tie. We're going to be moving in, and Dave just said his brother isn't even going to be there when we arrive. John glanced back worriedly at the trailer their car was towing, stuffed full of heavy furniture and burdensome gestures. There might have been more to move had they been coming from their original home back in Washington, but there's only so much a family of two can accumulate during the 3 years after the apocalypse. They spent the whole day yesterday driving from Denver, and the night in Amarillo with the intention of avoiding the worst traffic of Dallas today. It had only been 3 hours, but boredom was already overtaking John. The most exciting thing he'd seen so far was a dented highway marker that was stabbed into the ground upside down. Losing signal, and therefore his lifeline to Dave, prompted him to annoy his dad about his attire. His father's face, statuesque in stoicism and stillness as always, continued to perspire as he replied, raising a declaratory finger to the sky. "You know, Junior." John rolled his eyes at the nickname. His dad tended to bring it out to foreshadow a life lesson. "As much as I'd love to be bumming it out in some Tommy Bahamas or even something more practical like those cargo shorts of yours, there's a fundamental fact about life and manhood." He lowered his hilariously out-of-place Ray-Ban Wayfarers to look John in the eye with a steely blue gaze. "You only get one first impression." John balked at the gravitas his dad said this with, feeling some of his own sweat trickle unbidden down his neck. The younger man broke first, glancing toward the road.
"Dad!"
John yanked the wheel to the right, away from the shadow that appeared in the road. The sedan's tires let out a squeal of protest as they careened sharply into the dry sand of the desert. The trailer shuddered ominously, threatening to overturn, and when they launched off a bump, the thing uncoupled and started rolling away. John's dad slammed on the brakes, slowing their momentum just enough that when they hit the tree-sized cactus, it only caused them to snap forward against their seatbelts, rather than through the windshield. There was a moment of silence as John and his dad processed the last few seconds, interrupted by their car's alarm going off unceremoniously late. After frantically making sure John was in one piece and suffering no ill effects, his dad unbuckled and stepped out of the car, making pained noises as he inspected the front of the sedan. John stepped out likewise, scanning the road they came from. From what he had glanced, a tall, dark, and massive figure with long hair had leaped from a sparse copse of trees right into their path. At least it looked like the trailer didn't flip and was only a short distance away. Eyes adjusting to the sun, John was slow to realize that a dark spot in his vision was getting larger, no, closer. It resolved into the shape of a very tall man with very thin legs walking towards him. Only when he saw a second pair of legs did John realize that they were in fact a horse's, and that he was looking at an honest-to-God centaur. John's eyes bulged at the humanoid half of the monster. He looked like the cover of a tacky romance novel, his bronze skin glossy with sweat in the sun, his raven hair blowing in the desert wind. He had strong features, but his eyes were covered by a pair of cracked sunglasses. His horse half was tall and thick, its coat thin, gray and velvety-looking. He trotted up to John, not drawing notice from his dad, who was busy assessing the damage.
"You should be more."
His face twitched in an unattractive manner, as though remembering something unpleasant. He snorted in a decidedly horse-like manner.
"My apologies for my sudden appearance. Commuters on this route are not frequent, if present at all."
As he spoke, John noticed he was missing a number of teeth.
No problem, man. Can I call you man? Is that weird for you? You're the first...
John stopped to think of what the people on the radio were calling these creatures that, for all intents and purposes, looked and functioned exactly like mythological monsters. His dad's words echoed in his head.
"Centaur. Yes, I've no qualms with the colloquialism."
He was saved by the stranger answering for him.
"I found I'm the first of my kind many humans have seen since deciding to move to the city."
The centaur turned slightly to look longingly at the open desert.
"But despite how strongly I may feel, my duty, my partner, calls me."
John noticed for the first time the pack strapped to the centaur's back, his horseback, which included a modern-looking compound crossbow folded up and attached to the side.
"Oh, yeah, we're moving to the city, too. We have friends there. We're from Washington. I'm John, by the way."
He stuck up his hand. The centaur raised an eyebrow, but extended a hand John now noticed was wearing fingerless gloves.
"Equius of Clan Zahak. You may call me Equius."
His hands were so unbelievably wet, his grip nearly took John off his feet, however. Equius looked over towards the indented bumper of the car and the detached trailer. Without asking, he trotted over to the trailer and tossed a lasso he produced from his pack expertly over the hitch and started single-handedly hauling the entire thing over to the car. He dropped it a few feet away from the car's hitch with barely a grunt of effort.
"Will you all be fine to continue your journey? I must return to my homestead and then the city in haste," he said.
John interpreted his dad's blustery frustration on the other side of the car as indicative of only superficial damage to the sedan.
"Yeah, I think we'll be fine. We'll be all right traveling in this heat. I don't know if we can fit you in the car, but maybe we can make room in the trailer?"
John glanced dubiously at the rental. Equius raised a hand.
"I've lived on these plains my whole life. I can travel in the heat with ease."
He reached back toward his pack, pulling a long, flexible straw from some pocket.
"Also, I have a camelback."
That elicited a chuckle from John. Finally, his dad came around the trailer.
"Seems like the old wagon is only a little worse for wear," he said, dusting his hands off. "If I had a nickel for every time a horse ran me into a cactus..."
He stopped short upon noticing the hulking form standing next to his son.
"Dad, this is Equius. He says sorry for jumping in our way since the roads around here are usually empty."
John gestured towards the centaur. His dad took the introduction with too much of a stride, immediately falling upon Equius with a fatherly concern and simultaneous chiding. Only now did John notice that despite the Adonic musculature of the centaur, he seemed to be around the same age as John, or at least he looked the part. Aqueous looked cowed, but oddly pleased about it.
I issue my apologies once more. If there's anything I can do to atone for this, Aqueous began.
John cut him off before he started offering to flagellate.
You said you'll be back in Houston soon, right? Maybe you could show my dad around since I already know a local, he suggested.
Aqueous offered a snappy nod. After all was settled, Aqueous trotting into the distance and their car back on the road, John wondered if this would be life from here on out, stumbling through niceties and conversation with fantastic things from Greek myths. Not that Aqueous was unpleasant or anything, but if centaurs were real, what else had made its way to the surface? Rose. A pale, black-clad creature of the night stalked the half-flooded roadways of Houston's downtown, fixing any passerby with a dead-eyed glower. Hand in hand with a sun-kissed girl way out of her league who held a crimson umbrella up over the both of them. Rose Lalonde and Kanaya Grubb, respectively, made their way to Rose's favorite reliquarium of esoterica, Makara's Miraculous Miracles and Sundry. The "and sundry" was a recent addition, or so Rose deduced. It was a result of the sea level rocketing up a few yards and thus turning previously landlocked properties into beach houses. To think the world once feared an ocean rise of merely a few feet. She sniffled from the chill the persistent drizzle brought forth. A sharp, black fingernail ran its way down her palm in a way that made her shiver. Yes, the world was cold and gray, but her girlfriend was very soft and warm. Kanaya gave Rose a soft smile.
"What are you thinking about?"
she asked. Voice threaded with that staccato cadence that sounded endearingly like a science fiction artificial intelligence that would go on to attempt to genocide the human race in the latter half of the film. Rose's eyebrows drifted up.
"The folly of man," Rose replied smoothly. "And how in his—"
"Or her," Kanaya interrupted.
"Pursuit of progress, innovation, and knowledge. They unknowingly doom themselves to this eternal pursuit— chasing concepts which themselves are defined by evolution, and in the flush of the fowl, the wetland is diminished. I had a feeling that most of the world would have come around to cooperating against climate change had the meteors not struck," Kanaya replied, flawlessly.
The way her partner always seemed able to read her mind despite the walls of pseudo-intellectual chaff Rose habitually produced never ceased to awe her. Eventually, the couple came to a small storefront with dark wooden siding. Trimmed glass windows permitted a glimpse of soft orange light and a spattering of oddities arranged within. Approaching the door, Kanaya lengthened her stride to get ahead of Rose, elegantly manicured fingers grasping the doorknob. In a smooth motion, she pulled the door open with one hand, tucking Rose forward into the dry safety of the doorway with the other. Rose smiled, feeling a blush color her pale cheeks at the gallant gesture. Once Kanaya followed Rose inside, the umbrella closed, dripped, and dropped in a vase with a few others of its kind. They wiped off their feet on the doormat, reading, "Have a blessed day," and looked around. Makara's Miraculous Miracles and Sundry assaulted their vision with an amalgamation of objects, arranged haphazardly on shelves and in piles. Despite Rose's dubious title as a regular motherfucking ninjette, as a rewards card proclaimed, each visit was as confusing and labyrinthian as the last, due to Mr. Makara's unfortunate habit of revamping his wares, shelves, and wall decor weekly. Rose had a personal inkling that Mr. Makara infused the shop with some of his innate magic, and that it was as mutable as his body. She had no confirmation, though. He could just as well be putting up wall facades and making everything so confusing that it just seemed as though the floor plan changed. He seemed to be going for a Western theme today, as the mounted eel skull on the wall sported a jauntily tilted, comically small cowboy hat. Rose couldn't help but snicker at the thought of an eel on horseback, an undignified sound escaping her lips that made her girlfriend quirk a brow at her silliness. Rose chose to omit explaining herself and let go of Kanaya's hands to begin her search for the next item to grace her bookshelf. Today, the items closest to the door were a collection of dolls, mostly of the clown persuasion, Mr. Makara's favorites. Rose briefly made eye contact with a smartly dressed ventriloquist doll, his large blue irises and gay expression of glee familiar to her for some baffling reason, but she quickly moved on, venturing deeper into the shop. True to the recent rebranding, the next pile she ran into was a shoddy menagerie of dried starfish and sandballers. She didn't bother to wait for her girlfriend as she moved past it, knowing Kanaya was already heading for the counter to wait, more keen to strike up a conversation with Mr. Makara than to get lost tracking Rose down. A few turns took her past a canoe haphazardly piled with green glass cookware. A hand-painted sign proclaiming "Genuine Uranium" hung on a protruding oar. Dresses dangled from the ceiling, strange incantations sewn into the skirts and odd patterns of precious stones swirling across the bosoms. Rose briefly contemplated trying on the dark purple velvet gown that smacked her in the face, but it felt curiously vermicular to the touch, so she kept moving. Soon she had reached a door set into an internal wall which sported a chalkboard sign reading, "Do not enter, eel." Rose knew better than to disregard the signage, but this was a welcome landmark in her quest. She sighed in frustration, dragging her fingertips across the sign in a half-hearted gesture. The nails, bitten down to the quick, didn't even make a sound against the chalkboard. Using the wall as a guide, she turned left, walking past several aisles with foul smells emanating from them. One aisle, particularly dimly lit, had a plush reading chair at the end, but a few steps between the shelves revealed a disappointing array of hamsters and arachnids in large terrariums, not a single book in sight. The armchair, as it turned out, was not plush. It simply sported a large, white, fuzzy tarantula, which perched on the seat and gnawed on a bone. A scarlet leash kept the spider tied to the chair, and Rose backed out of the aisle with haste, knowing that Mr. Makara's shop spider was always hungry. It was as she was backing away that she noticed the ladder dangling from the attic trap door, a book lining each rung like breadcrumbs. She smiled and swiftly navigated to the ladder, eager to begin the fun part of her shopping trip. At the top of the ladder, a bibliophilic heaven awaited her. Row upon row of bookshelves, all blessedly labeled in an alphabetical order, an uncommon occurrence when dealing with Mr. Makara. There was even a section dedicated to hard and heavy stuff, a new expansion of his wares that seemed to primarily feature clay tablets and carvings. A feeling of excitement began to grow in Rose as she approached the stacks of slabs. She slid aside some copies of Old Yeller and Charlotte's Web, her perusal instinctively guiding her to a fan-shaped piece of beautifully polished scrimshaw with neat lines of precisely carved, well, it sure wasn't English. The whalebone, perhaps a foot long and a foot and a half wide, was covered in what, to the untrained eye, appeared to be rows of slash marks. Rose was admittedly untrained, but her close friend Dave had a love of the ancient and had pontificated on the glory of those slash marks in a vulgar rhapsody that she admittedly tuned out. The point was, this was a language, and she knew what it described must be special. In no small part due to the top third of the scrimshaw, the widest part of the fan, bearing a massive circular carving that absolutely screamed a summoning circle. At the corners of the piece were three bored holes, through which threaded a thick, oddly modern nylon rope. From the way it was knotted and strung, it almost seemed to form rudimentary backpack straps, though one was clearly sheared through. And there was a small sticker censoring a sigil in the middle of the circle, Mr. Makara's familiar scrawl denoting its price. $20 down payment and 5 pies due in 2 weeks. It was a perfectly reasonable price, given the obvious value of the item, and Rose resigned herself to a series of baking misadventures in the name of the mystical arts. She carefully cradled her prize and descended the ladder, her thoughts a feverish swirl of planning and potential. Ever since the suburban catastrophe revealed magic and monsters, alternatives to the world, Rose had become consumed by a ravenous need. If those people had magic, why couldn't she? So as soon as the dust settled and Mother Dearest began ignoring her again, Rose began her search. She must have searched hundreds of abandoned stores, landfills, lost and founds, personal libraries. A dark thought passed her mind that the hunt for magic was becoming an addiction to rival her mother's. She put it out of her head. Suffice to say, when she met Mr. Mikara, a genuine magical person, she was absolutely willing to put up with his chicanery, if only he could teach her. Approaching the front of the store, Rose ruminated on that first meeting, where Mr. Mikara gently explained that he wasn't human, and his kind of magic was pure motherfucking miracle, sis, and nothing that could be passed on through private lessons or book learning. However, he was a collector of all sorts of oddities, and now that the secret was out, he was eager to expand his wares into genuine magical artifacts, and promised to keep a lookout for the good word. So Rose became a regular ninjet, that is, frequenting his shop alongside her long-suffering girlfriend on a weekly basis. The girlfriend of reference, Kanaya, was sitting on the counter, chatting with the obnoxiously tall Mr. Mikara, the only way her petite amore could meet his eye level. Rose knew Kanaya didn't understand her obsession, her burning desire to flay magic down to the bones and transplant the marrow into her body. But Kanaya had adjusted quite well to the alternatives, being one of those humans who was already in the know. It was a terrible thing. Discovering her girlfriend was keeping such a huge secret from her, but when Kanaya introduced her to Mr. Mikara and heard the strange, soft-spoken boy, for he was a boy, really, only taking the form of a man to pay his taxes, speak of his years in hiding, Rose softened a little in understanding. Hiding from those who would hurt you, that was something she understood. So Rose moved past the revelation, began her quest in earnest, and Kanaya used the weekly excursions as a way to catch up with one of her odder friends, making sure he was taking care of himself and checking that his favorite clothes still fit the form he was shifted into. Rose approached the pair, clearing her throat softly in order to get their attention without barging into their quality time. The duo looked over at her, taking in the large bone cradled in her arms like a beloved cat. Kanaya hopped down from the counter, her shiny green galoshes barely making a thud as she landed with cat-like grace. Rose took a split second to appreciate the shape of her girlfriend's legs beneath the warm leggings she wore before her skirt settled to cover them. "What have you found this time, my darling?" Kanaya asked as Rose closed the distance between them, presenting her find for inspection. "A summoning circle in whalebone," Rose said eagerly, carefully tracing the circle with her index finger, tilting the bone towards her. "It's covered in some old language. I think Dave has an artifact with similar marks. Once I've paid," shuffling through a pocket awkwardly, she produced a rumpled $20 bill, "we should head to the Strider residence and get his opinion on the piece." Rose stepped to the counter, carefully placing her prize on the smooth wood and looking up at Mr. Mikara. The boy had a whole half foot on Rose's already prodigious 6'6". The fellow teen enjoying his freedom to no longer be confined by human proportions. He smiled at her warmly, his row of pearly white molars on full display, not a canine or incisor in sight. The customization of his teeth was a bit unnerving, but he seemed to enjoy the blocky shapes, so Rose smiled back, presenting her $20 bill.
"Hey there, my wicked ninja, you all up and shop to your heart's desire?" he asked, carefully examining the scrimshaw on the bill. "This is a special find, sis. I'm real proud of this one. You're going to be able to make the pipe payment."
His eyes bore into Rose's with intensity, and she nodded curtly. "Absolutely, Mr. Mikara. I know a thing of pristine value when I see it, and 5 pies for such a find is no skin off my nose. Do you want me to bring them in 1 week or 2? Inwardly, Rose cursed herself, worried her over-eagerness would make him up the price, or worse, ask for all 5 pies in a single week. She wasn't that skilled of a baker. John would be in town soon, wouldn't he? His dad was supposed to be skilled in this department. She began plotting ways to enlist her friend's parents into pie labor when Mr. Mikara answered,
"Aw, girl, 2 weeks is fine, just like it says in the sticker. Speaking of, let me just..."
He delicately slid a claw under the label, pulling up and off the sigil in a way a girl with mutilated nails simply couldn't replicate.
"Just bring him in 2 weeks, in this."
He reached beneath the counter and pulled out a large purple carabiner with 5 insulated pie carriers hanging from it. He looked quite proud to have this on hand as he compressed the 5 lunchbox-like objects into a flattened form in a shopping bag, carefully sliding the scrimshaw in the middle of the stack to protect it for the journey. He placed the $20 bill in his antique cash register, then handed Rose the bag.
"A pleasure doing business with you as always, Mr. Makara,"
Rose said, adjusting the shopping bag of treasure and pie containers in her hand.
"Great seeing you both, of course. And Rose, you really ought to call me Gamzee. All my friends do."
Rose politely chuckled, mentally refusing to drop her veneer of politeness when acting in her capacity as a customer, friendship or not.
"I'll try to remember, Mr. Makara. Goodbye."
Rose twirled on her heels, ignoring the disapproving look on Kanaya's face as she grasped her love with her free hand, eagerly pulling her towards the door.
"Come, my dear, let's not dawdle. I'm sure Dave is home, and we really ought to show this to him post-haste."
Rose was absolutely brimming with enthusiasm, an enthusiasm she was sure Kanaya viewed as the setup to another disappointment. But this time was different. She could feel it in her bones, her whale bones. As they stepped out into the dreary day and began walking to Dave's apartment, Rose reaffirmed the feeling. There was something here, something real, and she was going to take it and make it her own. Her best friend depended on it. Dave. Dave wondered if he would spend the rest of his life afraid.
"I mean, it makes sense. Animals want to live. Why wouldn't you be afraid of shit that could kill you?"
he thought.
"I guess the human brain didn't catch up to everything that came after high-level thinking. Now I'm afraid of shit like flopping on SoundCloud, the vastness of the universe, and also microwaves."
He wondered if any pedestrians would take the 6 stiller shades off his corpse.
"It was a good run," he thought. "I came, I swagged, I died handsome."
The air rushing past him as he fell from the roof of his umpteenth-story apartment building was indifferent to this cool guy's mortal musings. Some onlookers at the street level gasped and pointed in horror as they saw his small form plummeting. 3 years ago, the sky was red. Dave watched a burning fireball streak across the sky from his apartment window. Sirens, alarms, and screams sounded from the streets below, and Dave swallowed dryly as he stepped away from the living room window. Bro didn't seem worried. Well, actually, he did seem worried, but not in the bro way where he barricades every entrance to the building, equips himself with swords, daggers, and crossbows, and tells Dave not to come out of his room. Bro was pacing and chewing on his thumbnail, quietly stressing like a normal person waiting on a call back for an interview. This was intensely troubling to Dave.
"Hey, bro,"
Dave said cautiously. Bro seemed to remember Dave was present in the room with him and turned to look at him.
"Should we be..."
Dave was figuring out how to phrase it in a way that didn't make him seem like a panicking child.
"Bailing? All this shit seems kind of intense."
Despite his best efforts, Dave couldn't keep a slight tremble from his voice. Bro took a moment. He seemed to be mulling something over in his mind. Finally, he walked closer to Dave, taking a seat on the futon with a sigh.
"You know what I do for a living, right?" Bro asked.
It sounded rhetorical, but Dave was never 100% certain. "You're an assassin?" Dave put forward the best guess he'd ever come up with. Bro clicked his tongue in disapproval. He looked at Dave through his impermeable shades.
"Close? What did you think I did when you were a kid? And believed in Santa and all that?" Bro asked, staring intently.
Dave thought back, not very far back, but in the past nonetheless. He remembered Bro leaving for the night armed with wooden stakes, pints of salt, copies of religious texts, treating wounds that looked suspiciously like fang or claw marks in the bathroom sink, carving sigils above the doorways and leaving iron horseshoes around the apartment, sometimes hidden within the flesh of puppets to the frequent dismay of Dave's pinky toes.
"I guess I thought you hunted monsters or some shit," it embarrassed Dave to say aloud.
Bro was eerily silent. Dave let out a strangled laugh.
"You're really fucking with me while it's looking like Judgment Day out there? Come on, man."
"Monsters are real, Dave. Though we generally classify them into fairy, undead, shifter, eldritch, or some combination thereof."
"We?"
Dave asked. A passing meteor lit the room up red, throwing a glare across Bro's glasses.
Hunters.
Somewhere beneath the panic, it pissed Dave off how perfectly timed and fucking cool that was.
Okay, Dave said, sarcasm biting through to the surface. You hunt Nosferatu. What does that have to do with the fact that the city is falling the fuck down around us?
It has everything to do with the city falling the fuck down around us, Bro returned.
You need to know that monsters are real, because in a very short time now they're going to be living among us.
He stood up, pacing again. 2 millennia ago, the founders of my order were granted a prophecy that at the end of days, when a great net encircles the earth, and the garden does not flower, hell will rain from the sky. Those are the days that monster and man will be forced to walk hand in hand or surely perish. He made the dismissive gesture. Paraphrasing, but you get the gist. So far, the world has lived in a very fucking tenuous balance between human civilization, factions of monsters, and hunters. We keep the peace. Make sure any monster that goes to upend the secrecy gets justice. He punctuated justice with a thumb across his throat. Once the secrecy goes out the window, well, we can only punish them for crimes we actually catch them committing, which is much harder and basically being a cop. Bro looked unenthused at the prospect. Summarily, I'm not worried about the meteors because our city has defense systems for this shit. Same as every other big city. Not much is going to hit the metro. Also, this entire building is magically watered and about 600 times more structurally integral than the next high-rise over. Dave exhaled a breath he wasn't aware he was holding. If you have any friends in the suburbs, though, they might not be so all right, Bro said as an afterthought. Dave choked on that breath, immediately scrambling to his computer.
Ectobiologist, offline. Tentacle therapist, offline. Garden Gnostic, offline.
2 years ago.
One new message from Tentacle Therapist, TT. TT.
Dave, are you there?
TG.
Fuck you all the way to hell.
TT.
I'm glad you're alive too.
TG.
It's been a whole fucking year and I've been the only one online. Where the shit have you been?
TT.
The Rocky Mountains, in one of Dear Mother's secret bunkers. You'll recall my absence from all online spaces about a week prior to the meteors. She knew they were coming. Not that she told me anything, nor permitted me to tell anyone else.
TG.
Fucking same here, apparently. Have you seen the monsters?
TT.
How could I not?
TG.
Turns out my bro knew they were here all along. Calls himself a hunter.
TT.
Why am I not surprised? That seems quite fitting.
TG.
Fuck. It's good to talk to you again.
TT.
Likewise, David.
One new message from Ectobiologist. EB.
Dave!
TG.
What's up, man?
EB.
Dude, you sent so many messages, my finger hurts from scrolling to the bottom. Sorry about that, I just got a solid connection back. I'm still in Denver from my dad's business trip. Are you still in Houston?
TG.
Yeah?
EB.
What happened over there? I saw missiles shooting up and hitting meteors here, and it was just like deep impact. Holy shit, have you heard about monsters? We're apocalypse survivors now. We have to trade war stories.
TG.
For sure. Glad you're alive and shit, by the way.
EB.
You too.
TurnTech Godhead, TG, began pestering Garden Gnostic, GG, offline. TG.
Hey, Jade, I know we don't have internet yet, but...
TG.
John and Rose texted me.
TG.
I know you weren't like the tightest and you wanted privacy and shit, but...
TG.
Help, you're all right.
Error. Pastor Chum messages cannot be sent at this time.
1 year ago.
TurnTech Godhead, TG, began pestering Garden Gnostic, GG, offline. TG.
Hey.
TG.
We're all still looking for you.
TG.
Rose thinks she found something on her mom's computer.
TG.
You lived on an island, right?
TG.
We found some flat logs that went over what we think was your areas.
TG.
They'll probably never even see this.
TG.
We all miss you.
Error. Pastor Chum messages cannot be sent at this time.
5 minutes ago.
EB.
That rules! We're hitting low signal, but I'll message when we get in range again. Talk to you later. Actually, see you later.
TG.
Hella.
Dave tossed his iPhone 4 onto his bed from across the room. It was probably the most advanced piece of smartphone technology the world would see for a good while, and he took pride in that. Bro had found a box of them on a downed air freighter and jailbroke all of them to run on the P2P network most of the U.S. was now communicating on. He traded away all but the three he kept for himself and the one he handed Dave 3 days late for his 14th birthday. He was going to finally meet John in person. It made him feel kind of weird. Yeah, they were like the tightest of bros, but man, he just got used to seeing Rose in person, and the only really awkward part of that was seeing that she was as tall as Michael fucking Jordan. He wondered how tall John was. Dave needed some fresh air. He climbed the stairs to the roof and looked out at the gray expanse of ocean and sky, dotted with half-sunken buildings like pieces of soggy Halloween cereal floating in a bowl of milk that absorbed all the black food coloring. Beachside property for sure. Dave sighed. Now he was hungry. He heard a wing flap behind him. Damn crows never left him alone when he was up here. Fuck off, I don't have any breadcrumbs. As he turned, something massive, at least 10 feet wide and fast, barreled towards him through the air. Dave took a panicked step back onto nothing. Present.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of evil, I shall fear no death, because I'm the meanest motherfucker in the valley.
Falling to his death was taking forever. I guess what everyone said about your life flashing before your eyes was sort of true. Nobody says what happens when you're young, and the death is taking a proportionally long time. Turns out you can basically chill after all the other stuff is over. Dave turned over in the air and saw the ground. I was approaching much too quickly. He let out an undignified shriek and started flailing. He heard a gorgeous masculine voice over the wind suddenly.
Of course, now you decide to start flailing.
Dave felt something sharp close around either of his biceps and grip tightly.
God?
Dave asked.
Close enough,
the voice responded. Dave decided he didn't like God's tone very much. Dave felt a yank of inertia as his descent slowed and heard massive wings beating. The sharp things cut into his arms. His shade slipped off his face and he scrambled in the clutches of whatever this thing was to catch them.
Stop wriggling, it yelled.
Dave managed to catch the glasses and held them tightly. Despite the wings, they hit the ground with a not inconsiderable amount of momentum, and both Dave and the thing took a tumble. Dave sat up, dazed, but grateful he didn't take his iPhone up to the roof. The other guy also sat up. It was, in fact, a guy, mostly. Dave saw gelled, dark brown hair streaked with purple, wings protruding from a tanned swimmer's body, heavy, scaly claws in place of legs, and a bespectacled face that screamed, "My foreign dad has so much fucking money." They both took a second, evaluating one another as onlookers started rushing over to check on them. They both immediately realized they were obviously natural enemies in the social hierarchy. They both stood up and started yelling at each other for standing on rooftops and flying in people's faces, respectively.
"You realize I just saved your life, Shades?"
The birdman scoffed and threw his scarf over the other shoulder.
"Oh, so you're just like a douchebag, huh?"
Dave replied.
"You knocked me off my fucking roof in the first place, you brainless, feathery asshole!"
The birdman took a step towards Dave. When another voice yelled from the forming fight circle of pedestrians, high and bubbly.
"Aaron, what the glove are you doing?"
An absolute babe trotted between them, facing this so-called Eridan. She was quite short, with a bouncy mass of ginger hair that curled down to the middle of her back. She was wearing a neon green tank top, the kind you see at boardwalk stands, jean shorts, and a neon pink fuchsia, maybe, drawstring backpack. Dave started when he realized the girl had turned to face him. Oh, Jesus, those were some eyes. They shifted between blue, green, gray, and black in the light like a kaleidoscope.
"I'm sorry, but Aridin here. He didn't mean to run into you."
"Tch," he heard Aridin mumble none so quietly. "I should've."
"Are you all right? We can take care of any medical bills if you need."
"Pfeff, come on." Aridin half-heartedly tried interrupting, but seemed to already know his protest was going to be ignored. "Nah, I'm Gucci." Dave dusted off the shredded knees of his jeans and the slices cut into his shirt at the armpit. "I bought them like this. Real Balenciaga shit."
"All right,"
this Pfeff acquiesced.
"We'll get out of your gills, I mean hair, so sorry about this."
She turned and started bodily dragging Aridin away. The boy turned to give Dave one last grimace before beginning to walk with the girl.
"We have to live with humans now. You can't start a fight every time an accident happens,"
he heard her chastise as they left. Why did she say humans like she wasn't one?
Jade
Harley. Your name is not Jade Harley. You are not a 16-year-old girl. This is because your name is Becquerel Harley, Beck for short, and you're a very old dog. Not that you feel like one. Being a god dog has its perks, and you feel as fresh as a spring pup. Unfortunately, your world does not feel like spring at all. Your best friend Jade, your confidant and human pup, told you today was April 13th, 2009. She told you it was her friend's birthday. You don't know what to think about that, but you do know that today is special. Today is the day the hot rocks arrive. You've been smelling the hot rocks for ages since before this island existed, but you haven't been able to tell anyone except your own people. The canines know to hide from the hot rocks, to get away from the big water and climb mountains. Your pup Jade, your best friend, doesn't know she's supposed to get high. Her territory includes a volcano, but you know the hot rocks will make it more dangerous. You are going to take her away from here, use one of the metal bird box droppers to fly her to safety. You could use your powers to travel from here to there, but you've never taken a human with you on global jumps, and know she doesn't do well when you go from here to there across the island. The metal bird box dropper is coming soon, and you know it belongs to your dead best friend's packmate, the woman who smells sharp. Able to press against her thoughts until she thinks it's important, but she doesn't know why. You're unable to explain. She brings extra human pelts for herself and treats for you. You lick her face in thanks, then sniff the air. The metal bird box dropper is here. This time, instead of bringing Jade things, it will bring Jade to safety. You woof at her, shoving your collar at her hand. She grasps it on instinct, and with the bright green flash of your magic, you travel from here to there, landing among the boxes in the cargo hold. Jade looks upset, and your ears flatten sympathetically at her tone as she berates you. She thinks you were being mean or silly and wants to go back home. But you can't take her back home. The island, her territory, your dead best friend, will all be underwater soon. So you shake your head the way humans say no and whine at her until she stops yelling. You feel really bad about tricking your best friend, but you know there's nothing you can do to explain, so you snuggle against her in hopes that sleep will come for you both. It is to the sound of a horrible wail that you awaken, shooting to your paws and growling. You don't see danger, but you smell it. The hot rocks are coming closer, and something on the metal bird box dropper is burning. You go to wake up Jade, and feel your heart drop in horror. Your best friend is bleeding. You nudge her, but she won't wake up. The noise is getting louder, the smell is getting stronger, and you don't know what to do. You howl mournfully as the space around you plummets, careening toward the ground at top speed. A hole opens in the wall, and you inhale the scents of the air desperately, hoping to find a solution.
and a solution is in the air. You smell the sparkle of it. The fairy people have a gateway out there. You sink your fangs into the back of Jade's jacket, carefully dragging her towards the widening hole. You need to see outside for this one. With a green flash, your magic takes you both outside the craft, standing upon its wing, and you grasp her limp form tighter. With a mighty leap, you launch yourself from the spiraling death trap, the pair of you sailing through the air and through a glittering portal. On the other side, the ground is much higher than in the mortal realm. And your landing on fairy soil is a soft one. The shimmering green hill is pillowy with soft grass, and you lay your best friend down gently, nuzzling her face. The blood on her scalp is starting to dry, and you decide to guard her here until she recovers, safe from the hot rocks bombarding the mortal realm. You send out one last howl to your people, telling them the secret of smelling the sparkle, and hear them respond as they thank their god. They will find their way here, you know it in your bones, and they will be safe from the tricks of the Fae with you to guard them. Once the danger is past, you'll get the world pack back to their humans, and your pup will be all better. For now, you will guard her. Let her rest until she heals.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.